Welcome back, everyone. We are Little Brown Women, and this is our podcast, Unplugged. Every fortnight, we talk candidly with our wondrous guests and with each other about a range of important and topical issues, often from the lens of identity, culture, and empowerment. Today, we are so pleased to welcome our first couple onto the show, Niran and Christine. Niran is an experienced creative who has previously worked at both Instagram and Facebook, and is most recently a published co-author of the book, How to Build It. The book focuses on helping readers to find a way to thrive and grow their brands, and is published by award-winning book publishing imprint, Murky Books, which was launched by UK artist Stormzy and Penguin Random House UK. Christine is a creative project coordinator at the Salvation Army UK, with a background of working mostly within the charity sector in digital strategy roles. Most recently, she's become a lockdown baker and is the founder of Molten, a company dedicated to baking delicious bubble tea lava cakes, which incorporates Asian flavors. Together with their beautiful daughter, they have built a multifaceted and unique life together, which incorporates elements of their South Indian and Filipino heritage. In today's episode, we explore the beauty of their interracial relationship and challenges they have faced together, their individual identity journeys, and conversations around building businesses, and how they enjoy culture by living without the cultural constraints. So without further ado, let's get talking. Niran and Christine, it is so great to have you on our show. How are you both doing?
We are good, thank you. So good to be on your show. This is exciting.
I'm trying not to laugh. Thanks for having us.
I always cringe when I hear people talk about me.
I'm always awkward when it's when I'm being introduced to an event or something. I'm like, yeah.
Don't look at me.
The good thing is melanin hides the red blushing, so it's fine.
I'm really blushed, and I'm like sweating a little bit.
Yeah, I know how you feel. I mean, it feels weird to like even say it as well, because you're like, you know that you tend to have guests that are quite humble, so you know that they're also sitting there thinking, oh my god, they're talking about me.
Like, and then I'm gonna speak and then you'll actually not live up to this description. Oh gosh.
Oh, you guys do. We wouldn't say it otherwise.
Don't look at me too.
Oh no, it's fine. We are so pleased to have you on, and you are our first couple, so it's even more exciting for us. And so today we're going to kind of cover a few topics, but I thought I'd just get into the first sort of thing that we're all dying to talk about, which is interracial relationships. And it's funny because we live in such a diverse world, and yet it's still such a stigmatized issue. And personally, my fiance is Asian, but he's from a complete different culture. And so it's been slightly difficult in the sense of when I first told my family, it wasn't all balloons, cake and champagne. And so it'd be really interesting to hear about your guys' journey and really how you met, how you fell in love, and what your family's reactions were to sort of your relationship.
Go on, you can go first. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, you go first. All right. And then I'll tell the true version.
Ouch. So we both went to LCC Art School, London College of Communication in Redfern Castle. And we met in 2010. I was running my website back then, and I wasn't in a relationship for a while. I wasn't actively looking for a relationship, but we just started hanging out that summer. Actually, how did we meet officially? It was one of her friends, Abigail, used me for her an essay. She thought my style was interesting, so she wanted me to be like the person she based her essay on. And then I met Tin through her in the library, and I remember it was the day Twitter sort of launched and people were signing up to Twitter. And I was like, hey, has anyone got Twitter? And Abby didn't have one. And I heard her say, like, I've got it.
Yeah, just out of nowhere. I was just kind of overhearing your conversation. And yeah. Add me.
Which I knew she was obsessed with me from then. No. No.
Love it. The truth comes out.
So we just followed each other. And occasionally I think it was a tweet about Gossip Girl back then. She must have tweeted
it. You know you love me, XOXO.
And I was like, wait, that's Gossip Girl. Because I was religiously obsessed with Gossip Girl and the style on the show. Now that I watch the show's cringe. Like, it hasn't aged well at all. But yeah, we got talking and I was going to New York. and she must have been like, bring me back Hershey's Kisses.
That was a joke, because I love food. So,
and I think I tweeted saying, like, does anyone want anything from New York? Just as a thing, like, I'm happy to get stuff. And yeah, I got her Hershey's Kisses, and we met up, and she was in a relationship back then. So I was like, I ain't doing anything, nothing like that.
And you're then, still trying to be my friend, though.
Yeah, but I'm a nice person. I'm a nice human being.
Yeah, that's true. You still are a nice person.
Thank you. And then months went by, and it was that summer. I had an internship at We Are Social, which is based in Golden Square in Soho. And Tin saw my photography and was like, hey, would you mind teaching me how to use my camera better? She's had an SLR longer than me. I just used it more to get better. So she came and met me after work one day, and I remember she was sat in the square, and we walked down to near Tottenham Court Road. There's a what's the burrito place?
Chipotle.
Had a burrito there, and then just went for a walk down to Embankment and took photos together as the sun was setting. To me, that's our first date. To Tin and most women, that's not a date because it wasn't an official date.
Yeah, so it isn't.
It was 100% a date. We got to know each other better. I asked a question about her family.
You stopped at the sunset, like you're trying to pick this romantic scene.
Of course it was romantic.
Anyway,
we're here now, aren't we?
It sounds romantic. But you
that's
think
my I story. Do you want to change it to your own perspective?
My own perspective. The truth comes out. So I was in a relationship when I first met Niran, and it wasn't going very well. Like, the guy was dating. Yeah, I'm not going to go into that. But, you know, it was just that kind of ended, and I wasn't even looking for a relationship. And then just along comes Niran. He just was doing a lot with his life. He was writing a blog, and he just seemed very inspirational as a person. And he was just quite interested to kind of find out more about what he does and all of that. So I went on this photo walk with him, and that's all it was for me, just like hanging out with a friend, because I've just come out of a relationship. I'm not looking for anything, and I want to be like an independent woman, like all of that, you know. I don't need a man and all that. And then, yeah, we just kind of got really close as friends, hung out a bit more. And I think the more we hung out, you were getting feelings to me.
Correction. She had no friends that summer, and I was in Soho. Oh. And I had an internship. She had nothing better to do. And she lives in Zone 1, so she'd come and meet me after work pretty much every day.
Yeah. Basically, we're all Tin.
Basically,
I mean, there's no denial there.
That's fine.
But yeah, you naturally develop feelings if you hang out with someone for that long and you're both single. And time went by, and I think it was October 5th. I was the one who asked the question, where is this going? Because A, I'm final year. B, I've got a site to run, and I want to be focused on my goals. And if I'm making time for a relationship, it needs to be a relationship. It can't just be like, we're seeing each other. And then Tim can explain what happened that day.
So then I was like, I'm not looking for a relationship. Can we just be friends? And he's like, no, we can't be friends. And then I was just like, oh, I don't know if I could lose him as a friend, because that would be a shame. We'd see each other at uni. It'd be really awkward. And it'd be quite a sad situation. So I didn't give him like an immediate yes, but it kind of just became like, okay, we're dating, but we just didn't say it.
You cut out the story. So we were in Joe and the Juice in Oxford Circus. That used to be the place that we'd hang, because A, being from Asian households, you're not going to bring your girlfriend or boyfriend to the house. Hell no. So we just go there after uni and hang out and watch Gossip Girl or like do our essays there. And then it was outside. There was a lamppost. I remember like that's when she was like, I don't want to be in a relationship. She was all sad. And when she said that, I was sad. But at the same time, I was like, yo, life moves on. Such is life. And we can't be friends because I've got feelings for you. It'll be a bit weird. And she was more upset, even though she was the one like, I am breaking up with you. I don't want to be in a relationship. Yeah. And the rest is kind of history.
The rest is actually history.
Oh, I love that, guys. That just honestly, it sounds like the best sort of young love. And clearly it worked because you guys are still here. still together. So obviously, so that was all great. And then moving forward, kind of when you guys decided to get married, spend your lives together, how did you break that to your families and what was their reaction?
That should be me, right? So yeah, actually, you can explain how your families
okay,
were.
Okay. So I just always kind of, I'd always dated Filipino guys. I thought I'd end up with a Filipino guy. Just because it's like, you don't have to explain everything, like they just get it. And I think my parents, well, mainly my mum, thought I'd always end up with a Filipino guy. So yeah, I never showed, like, not that I wasn't attracted to, you know, anyone that wasn't Filipino, but it's just, I was more drawn towards Filipino guys. After a few failed relationships, I just thought maybe, you know, Filipino guys aren't my thing anymore. And then with Niran, I guess I grew up kind of hanging out with lots of Filipino people. And I guess my stereotypes of different, like, I guess, races, just had a, I don't know, Niran didn't fit that stereotype of like a typical Indian boy growing up.
Yeah.
What is a typical Indian boy?
I'm not going to say. No, but back then it was kind of like the really tight tracks.
What are you trying to say?
You know, it was like, yeah, it's just.
Goes to Leicester Square clubbing.
You know,
or,
Oh yeah, sponsored by Shockwave.
Yeah, then we met, and then I just thought, oh, he's different. Like, he dresses really differently. I actually at one point thought he was gay because he spoke about his. He used to have like his hair's naturally really curly when it's long, and then he told me he straightened his hair with GHD straighteners. Now I don't even own. GHD.
I own two.
And he owns two. That's why I was like, I've never met a guy that looks after himself so well. And this whole like idea of metrosexuality wasn't a thing back then. I think more guys nowadays, it's just part of.
It's part of society.
Yeah, it's
now,
part of society now. But back then, the guys that I was exposed to didn't take care of themselves that well.
She dated hood guys. And I wasn't. I mean, I might have grown up in ends, but I took care of myself because my idol was David Beckham back then.
But then you used to dress like Chuck Bass.
Yeah, I mean, I like style. Style is like your word.
A blazer with like a pocket square, and I'll just be like this girl in like a hoodie, and you know, look like.
And then she upgraded herself. What?
Oh, but anyway, so back to my parents. When I told my my mum about Niran, I started kind of inviting him to my parents' church on Sundays, and he would come and hang out, and then my mum would be like, oh, who's this friend of yours? And she picked the most Indian name out of nowhere and was just like, what's his name again? Raj? I was like, Raj? Who is Raj? I know. I was like, his name is Niran, and I didn't say that he was my boyfriend, but, you know, it was just kind of she knew who he was, but we just never say it. Because once you put the label, they're like, oh.
I mean, parents always know, and they like to not know at the same time. Yeah. Pretend they don't know.
So she wasn't quite happy about that. She was just like, why don't you find, you know, a Filipino guy? Like, I know this lady, this auntie's got a son who's like back home in the Philippines. He like might, you know, be someone you want to talk to. I was like, no, thanks. but she was just trying to like set me up with all, like, put me in this directions of all these guys, and I was like, no, I'm just gonna stick with this one for now. And then yeah, I guess over the years my mum warmed up to him. Like, he came on a family holiday in 2012, and that was a lot of time of them like spending time together, getting to know each other. They're quite similar in terms of character. And they like to have like kind of heated discussions and debate, which I don't get involved in, but she just kind of she realized he's like character, he's a good guy, really cares for me, and that's when she opened her heart to him, and since then she's just been like, oh, my son.
Yeah. And then, so her family are really open.
It's always the same with me as well. My mom is like now my fiance's best friend, biggest fan. Yeah. 5 years ago, that was not the case. But she'll never admit to it though. But it is. We laugh about it now. But at the time, you're just like, oh my God, just get on. Just please get on. I really can't deal with the animosity.
Yeah.
So it's good. It's good to know that obviously things are now great. But what about you, Niran? So how does your experience differ? Was it similar? I don't know.
No, it's different because I've never really introduced my parents to any girlfriend. And I didn't want to because I know how my parents would react. Is A, she's not, even if she's Indian, it would have been like, if she's not from the same state,
Yeah.
And probably the same, speaking the same language and probably the same cast is problematic. But I told them from a young age that I'm not going to marry someone from India. And even then, I don't think it's one of those things like, he's young. I'm not going to pay attention to that. He'll do what's right when the time comes. And I didn't. I broke all the rules. And I think they should have probably expected it from my career path and art school and dropping out of uni before that, all of that stuff, that I was probably going to do the same with my marriage and do something different. So we were dating, and it took me 3 years to introduce him. Well, actually didn't introduce her myself to my parents. It was my birthday in 2013, I'd say, or 14. And we went to see my grandma because I'm really close to my grandma, and I wanted to introduce Tin to her. And my grandma's first response is she just gets up and hugs Tin. She's like a hugging person. The funny thing is that my family never even hugged. We never hugged each other ever. It wasn't a thing. That kind of affection wasn't really like a South Asian thing.
Yeah.
So Tin actually brought that into my family. Now we all hug each other. But my grandma was like all accepting straight away. I think in her perspective, she's lived through so much, from moving across countries, seeing people die, and she's like, we're all the same. I think that's her mindset.
Yeah.
Whereas that evening, my uncle and auntie told my dad that Naren's got a girlfriend, she's Filipino, she's not from India, blah, blah, blah. So I was out, I get home, and it's just like all fireworks. Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham scene. My dad's Amitabh Bachchan, I'm Shah Rukh Khan. A family type thing. He's like, you've broken our traditions, values, and culture. That was always like a line he would bring up: tradition, value, and culture. Mm. And I was like, well, funny thing is, me and Tin were from two different cultures, and I would say we're third culture kids too because we were raised in the UK, so we're rich in culture. Your idea of culture is just Kerala.
Yeah.
And even if we go to India, you would only ever go to Kerala. So your perspective of culture is very narrow. And I've always been someone who challenged my dad a lot on stuff. So we'd have heated debates and discussions. And I remember he was crying from all this. And it took a few weeks for us to even have a conversation again. We just do the whole thing of when he comes downstairs, I go upstairs. When he comes upstairs, I go downstairs. I just avoid conversation. Or I just be at the house. And then we set up a meeting, and it was like, was it Pratt? No, what's the other place? Cafe Nero.
I think it was Eat
in Holborn, because my mom works around there, my dad works in banks, so it was easy for them to come. Did my sister come too?
No.
So we met, and it was fine. Like my dad's response was like, she's very nice. I was like, of course she's gonna be nice. What do you think she is? And then we did the parents meet, which was that after engagement?
That was after engagement.
So I proposed in January 2014 on the 25th. And I showed my parents the ring because I had the ring since December. And I don't think they grasped it that I was going to propose. And then when I did propose, my dad also had issues. Then he was like, this is not the way we do things. We go to their house, meet the family, give a sorry.
Yeah. All that crap. And you're like, no, we're going to do it differently, Dad.
I was like, Dad, this is not Kerala. Like, we're not in India. You raised me in this country. Actually, that was my argument is like, if you wanted me to marry a Malayali girl from the same caste, why didn't you move us back to India? We live in one of the most diverse cities in the world. And he can't say anything back to that. then we did the family meet. And it was we were so nervous about that because we didn't know what to expect. A, would they even understand each other because of their accents, their thing. And we did it in Beals, and it was a Saturday, we went for a brunch, and it was fine.
Yeah.
Like both dads just talked about immigrant life stories of coming to London.
From kind of like rural villages. So yeah. They're talking about all the crops that they grow.
And not having much when they grew up and all of that. They both got bellies. So there was like instant connection there and bond. And it was fine.
Yeah.
And they're like, then we like went to her house and they came to our house and it was fine.
Yeah.
It's really funny, isn't it? When you kind of see the older generation, and they always think, or they make a problem, they actually create a problem in their mind. But you guys just said when everyone met each other, it was great. They had so much to talk about because actually they have so much more in common than they want to allow themselves to believe they do.
Yeah.
And I think they moved here. They gave up everything to move here. And they put up walls in place for, I guess, security and comfort. It is the last thing they can hold on to is their traditions and culture.
Yeah.
And everything else has been taken away or they've had to try and adapt to survive. So for my family, like my dad is heavily involved in the Malayali community, and that's why he's based down. So he's an active participant. I've always stayed outskirts because of gossip folks. But I get it. I get it why they're like this. And our relationship has helped expand their horizons and open their eyes a bit more.
Mm.
And my friend circle has always been really diverse. So it's changed their perception of other communities as well. And seeing similarities in other communities.
I love that. I think sometimes it is that thing of where as a child, you know, of immigrant parents, you kind of have to step back. And even though they are making your life a little bit difficult, you've got to see where they're coming from. And then the way in which you approach sort of their ideologies is you just got to be a bit softer, I guess. But slowly, slowly, they almost live through your experiences. And as you said, Niran, and I'm sure Christine too, that applies to your family as well. They almost see you having your experience and they're a bit hostile at the beginning. But sooner or later, they kind of think, do you know what? It's quite nice. It's working out. Let's get involved. And then before you know it, all the other stuff is history and you're actually really enjoying this lived experience together, which is a really great thing. And so I guess, you know, when we see couples like yourselves, it's so nice because we know all of the other stuff that your relationship is helping to sort of get rid of, which is that sort of old generational kind of toxic attitude sometimes. And, you know, I think parents don't see it often, but as children, and as you said, you've both grown up here, you're like, you're super diverse because you have your cultural heritage, but you've also grown up in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. And I guess, you know, in terms of being in a interracial, intercultural relationship, I think we, between us three, Kay, Dami and I, we always wanted to create a space where our guests could talk about their experiences just to break the stigma that still surrounds those experiences. And so I guess I just want to end sort of this little bit of the conversation on how you've both adopted and appreciated each other's culture since you've been together. I don't know, is there something that you've really enjoyed about each other's culture or perhaps a favorite thing?
So I'm a big lover of food and food is my love language. So going to Niran's house kind of when we were still meeting the parents and all of that and just being served food. At first it was a bit strange because they would kind of just put the food on the plate and like his dad would always be like, here's more rice, here's this, and I'm just like, okay, I've eaten enough. But it's like I love eating food. I think they've always had to kind of tone down the spice levels because I'm like a medium Nando's like level, and I think your usual level is like borderline extra hot.
When I lived at home it was hot, but I'm pretty intolerant to spices now, which so, sadly
that's really sweet of them to kind of to be considerate about kind of spice levels and all of that. Also I think I would spend a lot of time with Niran's sister kind of before meeting the parents, so that kind of helped me ease into the whole process. And I was a bit worried at first because we didn't know what to expect when he told his parents about me, expecting worst case scenario, but also really hoping for the best. So I knew that it would take patience and it would take some time to warm up. So it was just making sure that we prioritized that and, you know, met up quite frequently, especially as we just got engaged, just to make everyone like feel comfortable and warm up to the whole idea. But yeah, I also love, I mean, we've not been to many occasions obviously in the last year or so, but I love going sari shopping like with Niran's sister. I could just spend the whole day just going to every shop, trying on everything and be like, that looks good. Oh my gosh, I like that one as well. But then they're not cheap. So you have to kind of find myself going back and forth. I'm like, I like that one from that shop. All of that. But it's like a whole day and it's just lots of fun. I've watched a few films, but I feel like I could watch more. because I love the cheesy drama kind of. We have the similar type of stuff in the Philippines, probably not as well produced, but
I'd say the people. I've been lucky enough to go to the Philippines twice now, but the first time was with her mom, which is a bit more curated by parents. We spent last year for our maternity leave, we spent a whole month in Philippines, and it was the first time Tin's gone without her parents, and it was, I kind of picked all the places we were going and staying, and we just did stuff that we would do here, like the restaurants, and discovered culture in a way that I don't think you've done before. And I loved them. My number one favorite thing was people are just so hospitable. They're the nicest people I've met. Everyone was so friendly and kind.
Hello, ma'am, sir.
Hello, ma'am, sir.
Would you like this number?
And I think even, what's his name? Anthony Bourdain says that in his Philippines episode. Like, they're so genuine and kind. And that's probably my favorite thing. And I remember even going to a family church in London. Everyone was so kind. Like, this is weird. Like, in London, strangers aren't nice to you. So that's probably my favorite thing about Filipino culture, and the desserts. The desserts are levels. I have issues with the rest of the cuisine, which is probably shady to share on a podcast. Because when you cook Indian food, there's like 20 spices in all stages of the cooking. Filipino food is a bit more soy sauce, fish sauce, garlic.
Onions,
and that's probably it. And more soy sauce and more fish sauce.
There's more to it than that, but yeah, okay.
Well, from what I've got, Niran, you're lucky because you love the Filipino people and you've got a beautiful Filipino wife. So, you know,
yeah,
you hit the jackpot, really.
Wow, you guys have such energy, and it's kind of amazing and relatable in terms of how your individual journeys, your upbringing, your experiences have brought you guys together today. And so I guess when I think about my journey right now, I'm still on that path, right? I'm still trying to figure myself out. My identity is continuously evolving. I'm always pushing myself in different zones, meeting new people. So I guess my first question is, are there any stories that you can share with our audience today in terms of any key moments in your childhood, in your adulthood today, that's kind of helped you with your individual identity journeys?
So I grew up quite sheltered. My parents were very overprotective over me. I've got a younger brother, with like a 6-year age gap. So my parents were like, oh, you're the daughter, like, stay home. You know, I wasn't really allowed out much as a child. And, you know, that didn't bother me as a child. But I think, you know, in primary school and secondary school as well, my mum would always encourage me to kind of be the best in the class and aim high and, you know, get the best grades and all that. So that's what I was kind of doing for most of my childhood. And then it's only when I got into secondary school and kind of uni where I was like, oh, how come I'm not allowed to go out? Where is my freedom, type of thing? And that's when I started to kind of push back a little bit, be a little bit rebellious, because I was just quite annoyed that I wouldn't be allowed and frustrated to just go out with my friends. I'd always be like, come home at 6 p.m. and it'll be like 6:05, like, you're late.
Christine, I feel you. That was the same for me as well.
You know, it's just, it's different when you're a girl. Whereas my brother, you know, he was allowed to move out for uni, whatever. Like, I was only allowed to move out if I was going to Oxford or Cambridge. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Why is it Oxford and Cambridge, though? Do you know what I mean?
I know. I was like, okay, well, sure. And then, yeah, so my parents, they both run a church in Northwest London. So, like, a lot of my identity has been rooted in my faith, and I felt like I had to kind of go on my own journey, because obviously you kind of just grow up, you go to church, whatever. But and I didn't think like any of that was for me until later on in life. I just thought, no, I'll figure that out when I'm older. But I think I just kind of found myself just wanting to search for like truth and for God and whatever. So I had to find my own, you know, my own path. And when I found that, I kind of just held on to that, and that's kind of what drives like all my values, the way that I live, all the decisions I make. Then uni years happened again, had a little bit of a rebellious streak. you know, these things happen. It's all part of growing up. But then I was still quite scared of my parents, so I wouldn't go do anything too extreme. I'd still come home like a decent hour, and just try and keep composed and not get clocked by anything. Had my phone confiscated a few times, but it's all good. You know, had like a boyfriend that I wouldn't tell my parents about, that type of thing. That would be the most rebellious thing I'd ever done. But yeah, so my identity now, I guess, since becoming a mum in the last 2 years, that's where I'm at the moment. Like, that's changed in itself. That's a whole different conversation, becoming a mum. I think I really struggled, I think, in the first year of becoming a mum, just to adjust, because I'd always wanted to be a mum, and my expectation versus reality was so different, and it was a huge just like learning curve. Still learning now, but yeah, that's where I'm at the moment. I still feel like Naraya's our world, and everything now that we do is based around her and giving her the best and all of that. So yeah, that's kind of me in a nutshell, would you say?
Yeah, it's such a complex question around identity.
It is.
I guess for me, hey, so when I do talks for work, I always start with a bunch of words on the screen, and one is Naran, my name, brown guy. The reason I put that there is because of D&I issues, and I want to call that out and make everyone feel uncomfortable. Indian, Londoner, creative director, photographer, and they both crossed out. And then my job title is creative strategist, gamer. And I try and explain what they all mean to me. And Indian's kind of a given, I'm brown. And Londoner is like, I always love repping London as well. Again, growing up in London and working in the industry, there's actually very few of us who are actually born in London. And so I like to rep the city in that sense. And then job titles are, we live in an age where everyone's given themselves titles. So I try and cancel it out. I just like making things. And then gaming is one of my biggest passions. And then vigilante is always been my end goal of becoming like Batman one day, which probably won't happen realistically, but who knows? But identity wise, like, grew up in a very similar to Tin, like quite a sheltered upbringing. I'm not a girl, but my parents were super strict. We weren't allowed out. I don't think I was allowed out until I was secondary school, when they give you the keys and you come home. But even then, I'd come straight home. Like, my parents weren't there, but I'd still come straight home. And sometimes I let my friends come in and we'd play FIFA. And even then, they'd have to leave like 5:30 before my dad gets home at 6 or my mom gets home at 6. And then what happened? I went to sixth form and I had really good grades and classic brown parents. I wanted to go to college and study graphic design. My parents were like, no, you go to grammar school, you should go to the grammar school. All boys grammar school, going from a comprehensive school in Newham to a grammar school in Redbridge or Barkingside. I kind of hated the experience of those 2 years there. I felt dumb because all the kids there were so ahead from doing triple science and triple maths. And it's just a different vibe. And I had to wear a suit there every day. I had to take an hour and a half bus to get to school. But it also gave me so much freedom. So I'd skip and do my own thing. My grades weren't great. Then I went to study game design at a uni up north, which gave me the freedom. I moved out. So I didn't have grades to get into some other colleges, universities. But in that first month of moving out, partied every night. I think I partied pretty much three, 4 nights a week for the whole year. Dyed my hair, got my eyebrows slit, got my ear pierced. I came home the first, I think, like second week. And my dad was like virtually close to tears, seeing like, what have you done?
I guess.
Yeah, and I took my mom's eyeliner to fill in the eyebrow slit. And identity was just like, I was just exploring what freedom looked like, not being a sheltered brown boy for a change.
That's it.
And though that year I ended up dropping out, which is, again, even more problematic because the brown kid to drop out, like, everyone's parents like, oh, so what does your son do? Oh, yeah, he's sitting at home doing nothing. And that year was weird for me because I was always designing on the side, and I ran another website back then and exploring my, like, what freelance design could look like. But I had no connections to the industry. My parents couldn't give me anything because they don't know anyone there. So I ended up just working on the website and then going to art school. And that kind of gave me the freedom to understand there are people that are into arts and creativity, and I found my people. And then starting the blog, expanding my network to find more like-minded people. And I guess identity, like you said, it's ever evolving. Right now, my identity, I'd say I'm a girl dad and a husband before anything else. Does that cover it?
You look like you're about to cry. You know?
I know, it's getting emotional.
I'm not gonna cry.
Grab me a tissue, quick.
I'm sweating though.
Guys, that was beautiful. Like, reflecting back on both of your experiences, I think journey for our inner identity and figuring that out, it's really lonely. Like, really lonely. And I found it really lonely. Like, going to primary school and like just being the only person of that heritage, coloured skin. And then again, Niran, I didn't follow the typical kind of medicine route. I went for a degree called biochemical engineering. My dad never even heard of it. He was like, what are you doing? You're not going to get a job in that. What is even that? I don't even know anyone who does biochemical engineering. But, you know, I'm happy today, and just look, like, hearing you both, you sound so happy, and I think you should be so proud of yourself. And so my second question is, from your upbringing experiences, how has that influenced your parenting approach or your parenting styles for your beautiful little girl, Naraya?
So I think before we got married, we did a thing called a marriage course, and I was like, why do we need this? Don't need to do this. But they send you like a 6-page like questionnaire of different topics, from things like how your parents communicate to, I don't know, how many kids you want, all this kind of jazz. And one of the sessions was on communication. And I thought we communicated pretty well. But then it was understanding that how our family communication affects the way we are as people. Yeah. So my parents are quite closed. Like, Indian families don't share feelings. I mean, even till this day, when I try and talk about anything to do with mental health and depression or anything, because there's been quite a increase in suicide rates, especially among men. And I try to talk to my dad. It just feel like it goes in one ear and comes out the other. So my parents are kind of closed in that sense. Can't really talk feelings. So I'm very open as a person, probably the opposite. And I was always quite introverted too. And for you?
Yeah, so I was, I guess, the opposite in that my dad, he's a man of few words, but it's my mum who kind of always has to have the final say. You know, she always like has to get her point across. And I just felt like growing up, I didn't really have much of a voice, because then she'd shut me down and I'd always be wrong and all of that. So I kind of say my thing, but then she wouldn't listen. So kind of my approach to dealing with conflict was to either just hide and avoid. Whereas I started, you know, when I was with Niran, they've got like the term where he's like the rhino, where he just charges and addresses the problem there and then. Whereas with me, I'm the hedgehog. So I kind of just need time to process. I need to sit with my thoughts. I need to make sure that I say the right thing. I need to understand what I'm feeling and all of this. So that was when we were like, oh, this is very eye-opening. This is interesting. And kind of through the years, we've managed to kind of like little arguments here and there. We know how each other works, and he knows to give me space, but then I know I don't need too much space, because then he'll get even more annoyed. So it's
finding the balance.
Yeah, it's finding the balance.
I guess when it comes to parenting, is also understanding how our parents raised us, taking and adapting a few things that they've done, and some stuff like you would never do. For example, I don't know if it's similar to you. My parents don't really say I love you or show love in words. Which is something I've never heard my parents say, I love you or I'm proud of you. It's not something they do. They show love in other ways, like picking you up from the station whenever you need to.
That's it. It's always the station, man. What time are you going to get to Walthamstow Central?
Yeah. Till this day, my sister will get a call from my mum and dad, like, where are you? Do you want us to pick you up from East Ham Station? And that's, I think, the way they would rather, you want food or. Like, even now, my dad will probably call up on the side and say, I'm going to Tesco, do you need anything? I was like, no, it's fine, just Tesco, 2 minutes from my house.
To this day.
So I've been quite vocal in using words of affirmation. I think we both have, with Mariah, it's like, that we love her and that she's beautiful, but not just words that around appearance, but you're brave, you're smart, you're strong, you're curious, all these things that people generally use for little boys, we try and use for her too, because building up her confidence and identity.
I think it's important, especially when you have a daughter as well, because like if they don't grow up with kind of that feeling, that love and that you know, knowing that that's who they are, as they get older, they'll look for that love and that, you know, approval from elsewhere. I said to Nora, and I was like, even before we knew Nora was a girl, I was like, if we do have a girl, you need to tell her every day that you love her. She needs to know that, you know, you're like the main kind of first like male role model in her life, and this is what a model man should be, and this is, you know, how it is. And
it's getting me kind of emotional, you know.
I know. Why you're drinking your water right now? Oh, this is so lovely.
It's just important because, yeah, we just want to kind of make her feel like she can achieve anything and do whatever she wants. And that with me, when I felt like I couldn't have a say in things, you know, whenever I find myself kind of trying to tell her off or whatever and say, no, this isn't right, I kind of let her have her moment and I let her express herself, even if it means it's like a 2-minute meltdown. I'm just like, okay, you've had your say now. Cool. Like, it's good to express how you feel. Like, be true to how you feel, you know, just express it. Whereas I felt I had to always kind of like hide that side of me because it just wasn't, it was always frowned upon to kind of be that girl that would be so outspoken or whatever. But I kind of want her to be. And she is quite a little feisty firecracker at times. And sometimes I'm like, wow, this is going to be great when you're older. But right now you just need to go to sleep and stop fighting for 2 hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not working out with the routine. Do you want to sleep at this time? Yeah, mummy and daddy can watch TV and then sleep as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So there you go. It's cool. It's like kind of knowing when to let go, picking your battles as well. That's important.
I think, Christine, I can relate to the feeling of not being able to voice your opinions. I think from our kind of cultural upbringings as well, you're kind of told to just stay quiet, listen to the parents, nod along. Clubbing? What's clubbing? No, you shouldn't be going out till late. Disco, sorry.
D&D used to sneak out. Oh my God. So we've known each other for over a decade. And when I tell you the amount of excuses we came up with, we get pissed. My God. We would run back home and we only live like a couple of roads, right? We would run back home, McDonald's in hand, heels on, like 18-year-old self, absolutely trolleyed after a night out in Fabric. So yeah, we definitely relate. We did the whole, like, we had the spare phone. So like if our parents took our phone, there was an undercover phone somewhere in the house. And then we hid it, like I would hide it between, like, you know, your bed, you've got like your mattress. So I would just slip it in there. Or like we go to school, we'd have like places in school where we just leave it. So we'd like swap out the Sims. Trust me, we've been there. It's honestly so relatable. And it's so nice to hear that like you've gone through such similar experiences. In like very different ways, like culturally, like as women especially. We're raised to be like, you know, don't go outside, otherwise society is going to think you're like some kind of bad girl. Like you step outside and you're like the rebel of the community. So it's so nice to hear like your experiences, how you've learned from that and how that has shaped you to make, you know, become the mother that you are today, the parents that you are today, to be a girl dad. That is so important. I grew up in a household, my dad doesn't say I love you. And, you know, when it came to finding a partner, it was so important that I had someone that would show me that comfort, because I don't have that. You know, my dad's never hugged me, and I'm almost 20, I'm 28 next month. My dad's not hugged me. Too. Yeah. You know, I got married last year. The best he gave me was a pat on the back, and it was like, really?
the classic pat on the back.
You know when you bend, that's like when you get married, you like you get a blessing from feet.
Is what you call it.
And then my dad like picked us both up and just went, yeah, okay, well done. <You're sweet." laughs>
Like, good job. Well done. Good job. That's it.
Honestly. So yeah, it's so relatable.
One thing on heritage, I think Indianness to me was funny growing up because it wasn't deemed cool. And it still isn't in mainstream culture because we're a long way away from getting South Asian, Asian narratives into mainstream media here. So I almost put that part of me in a corner and boxed it up because it wasn't cool. And then over the last 2 years, especially since having Naraya, is like, what does it mean to me? Exploring that more. She's a mixed race child. Mm. How am I going to teach her heritage from India if I don't know it well enough? I've boxed up. So over the 20, like in my 20s, I've been trying to get back into it and understand more and how I express it.
I mean, just to kind of go off from that, I would say with kind of growing up, I used to love hearing stories about my dad growing up, because both my parents kind of grew up, like, didn't have much growing up. There was like him and I don't know, 8 other siblings living in like this tiny traditional bamboo hut in the country. And they were all just like in this place. So when I'd hear these stories, you know, like him for his graduation, he had to borrow, you know, neighbors' trousers, which were way too big for him, didn't have like new flip-flops. They just had to make do. And he's really resourceful in that sense to this day. Like he'll just fix a problem. But it's just kind of hearing those experiences and just knowing exactly where they've come from. It's really humbling, puts things into perspective, especially in this day and age where everything's kind of handed to you on a silver platter. You know, we want Naraya to know the struggles that it took for us to be able to live and enjoy a life like this.
You're
emotional. I am emotional.
I think you're going to cry there, fam. I can relate. I can relate to that too. My dad always shared stories about how I had one pair, one uniform and one set of shoes, whereas like I have a lot of sneakers.
Too much.
And it's that whole, like, I don't know if you've watched a show called Blackish. They go through a similar episode where Dre is from Compton. He's like, I didn't grow up with much. And these kids are like privileged and they got everything. And when we were watching that before we had Naraya, I was like, damn, man, we're going to be going through this.
You're basically Dre, though.
Yeah, it was funny because Dre works in advertising too. And some of the race stuff that he goes through in the office, I was like, this is real life for me. That's one of the things of instilling really good values in her eye, but also helping her realize that there are people out there that don't have much, and understanding where our families came from as first gen immigrants. Like they had to hustle real hard to make sure that blood, sweat and tears to get us where we are. And me having the freedom to go into an art school and make a living through doing stuff creative, which is wild to probably all of their ancestors and family.
So shout out to our parents, right?
Word. It makes you grateful, doesn't it? Gratitude practice. Definitely.
Big up the hardworking immigrants. That pay tax, that we all pay taxes more than no comment.
HMRC, don't come for us. So I know both of you guys have your own well-established career paths, but with that, you're also building individual businesses as well. And ultimately, what I want to hear from you guys really is, what influences your lifestyle and how do you really live without the cultural constraints around that? I know, Niran, it was interesting to hear about your career and how you decided to go against the grain of what was culturally deemed as proper. And when I say that, I can relate to you in that sense, coming from a Sri Lankan heritage. My parents had, it was either a core subject or nothing. If you did something else, you were deemed as like the stupidest kid in the world. Family reputation was going to be ruined. So if you weren't doing medicine or accountancy, engineering or whatever it was, we were the black sheep. So how your culture has influenced you and pushed you into the businesses and into the creative career that you've chosen. And also you, Tin, it'd be great to hear how infusing your culture and creating molten cakes, that's beyond creative, because I've never thought of putting the bubble from the bubble tea into a cake, and it actually looks incredibly amazing. Like if anybody wants to have a look at those, you really, really need to, because they are melt in the middle, quite literally amazing. So it'd be great to hear what pushed you to go down the route of your career and what influenced you to culturally and perspectively to come together really and pursue that individually.
I guess I just fell in love with making stuff. And I always say my earliest form of creative expression was when one of my aunties got me a Lego bucket, and it was the 5+ one with the little bricks instead of Duplo. I got given that when I was 2 in 1990. And for me, that was my earliest expression of building things and breaking things and learning to tell stories using those little blocks and people. And I've always found joy in that. I like making things and getting into the zone of when you're in that zone of inspiration. And when I think it was going to A-levels, actually, I found so much more enjoyment doing Photoshop and design than the academic stuff I was studying. So that really pushed me into try to explore a career in this, but I had no idea how to do that. Whereas my parents wanted me to do the traditional, be a doctor, be a dentist, be a lawyer, be someone with an MBA, be an engineer. I mean, there's like, you can do the tick box. It's probably like 5 and you can expand on them. And it wasn't me. There are days when I think about maybe I should have become a doctor, about helping people. There is a sense of, I think anyone who's not in medicine probably questions what meaningful things they're doing to in their day job. I don't think people who are doctors have that, or nurses, or anyone in the medical field. That's kind of why I went into it. It made me happy.
I used to love watching shows like Changing Rooms. So then now the rooms are awful. Look at the photos now. But, you know, I always thought, oh, maybe I'd get into interior design or kind of graphic design. I loved design and technology at school. I would draw, I'd be really passionate about it. Like, art was also a good thing. And even to this day, like, I'll doodle here and there. And I do a bit of calligraphy as well on the side. So there's always been that kind of side of me. And I did an art and design foundation course at Camberwell College of Arts, which is part of the University of Arts. And yeah, I got there and I was like, actually, I'm not that passionate about design as I thought, because everyone here lives and breathes art. And for me, it was more of like a hobby and a side thing. So then my mum and my dad would be kind of like, you know, why don't you become a doctor as well? They weren't like forcing me, but they were just suggesting heavily, do something, you know, like nursing or doctoring. And I just thought, nah, that's not for me. Like, no. So maybe graphic design isn't my thing. But then I found a course at LCC where we went to, which is marketing and advertising. So it sounds like entrepreneurial. It sounds a bit more business. And so I took that on, learned a few things here and there, and then kind of went on to do like an internship in like a digital marketing agency, working with all sorts of like clients. But I found myself more drawn towards and more excited about the projects with kind of charitable clients, so nonprofits and all of that. And all the other ones, I was just kind of like, oh, it's just about hitting numbers and sales and, you know, hits and everything. Whereas when it came to kind of these charities and their work and getting their work out there and the message out, I'll just be like, yes, I really like champion this, and I'll just be so on it. And that's when I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna work for charities from now on, because I feel like I want to do meaningful work. And I guess I just, even if it means, I know the charity sector can be really slow and everything's like a dinosaur and there's so many processes and there aren't as many perks and the pay isn't always good, but I just felt like it needs, you know, if I'm going to work, I want it to better society somehow, even if it's in a big or small way. And usually my work is kind of behind the scenes, behind those on the front line. So what I'm currently doing at the moment is at the Salvation Army. They do a lot of things for different people in the community. They work with old people, young people, homeless people, people in modern slavery and all of that. So there's so many areas, and I just like, I'm really excited about all the work that we get to help out with and support. So yeah, and I'm able to inject my creativity, because I mean, I see what Niran does, and sometimes it frustrates me with how slow things are in the charity sector, because I have all these ideas and they're like, okay, we don't have the budget or we don't have the capacity, but we just get more creative. And I never was a person that was into kind of like the side business thing. Like, this whole Molten thing that came about was over during lockdown, and my brother, he weirdly enough, at 3 o'clock in the morning when he's hungry, he watches like these mukbang videos. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're basically just like,
oh my god, I love them.
Yeah,
I sit there and watch the ASMR videos, and my husband sits next to me. He's like, why can I just hear slurping? Like, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, don't understand. This woman is eating a lobster the size of her head. Like, I'm so hungry for it right now. I feel it.
But why would you watch it when you're hungry? Like, just go get food from the fridge. Like, you know, it's cool. Like, it's not like you've got no food. But he does that at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I think he came across a video, because Really Big in Asia, kind of like, I guess, something similar to a lava cake. And then he Googled online and he found like a recipe that was close to what we've got now. And he was like, do you think you can make this like just for bands? So I made it. And I was like, actually, this is pretty good. And then kind of did a search around. And I was like, this isn't here in the UK. It's big in certain parts of Asia. And I was like, there's a gap. Let's go for it. But at first, I was just like, actually, do I want to do this? I don't know if I'll be able to cope. Like, I'm a mum. There's all these other things going on. But yeah, just kind of got good feedback every time, you know, I'd get friends and family to try it. I was like, actually, there is something here. And yeah, it's been going well. I think the first few weekends was a bit overwhelming and I was baking nonstop. And then I'm also doing deliveries as well, because someone here doesn't drive yet. So I...
Wow,
it's the truth though, isn't it?
On a podcast.
Confessionals. We call this talking therapy.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, so that's Milton.
So her other side hustle is she's my Uber driver too.
Yes.
I've just downranked her to 4 stars.
So if anybody,
yeah, do you have any stars?
Get on to Niran to get his driving license, right? So we're going to start a trend. Hashtag Niran, get a driving license.
It's work in progress, but COVID kind of ruined it for me. But yes, I didn't actually explain my whole career journey. I went to art school after that, and if I'm honest, I didn't really learn much in creative advertising there. I think a lot of the stuff they were teaching was so outdated by that point because social had boomed. But I had a natural curiosity for all things digital. I was born into like internet. I've been obsessed with it since I was 11. Being part of online forums, meeting friends. I've always had internet friends. Like, most of my closest friends are people I met off the internet. And then I set up this blog because I was curious about websites and reading loads of other websites. I want my own thing. And I set up Yin and Yang, and it was with my best friend at uni at the time. And he was Yang and I was Yin. We just post about things we like, which is music, fashion, art, women, art, food, anything. Famous. Anything, yeah, sneakers. Anything famous. London related. And then we grew up during the process of like, oh, wait, this is what you call content. And brands are reaching out to us. And we had a decent following. And we'd go to events and we just learn a lot more about networking, but also build our network out and meet cool people in the industry and all get offered jobs and to shoot content and stuff. I'm like, this is weird. Like, we started this just for fun. And in the end, the site evolved from a blog to a more of a London lifestyle website where we had a collective of that we call the Yin and Yang family. And all of us, none of us are taking like a wage or a salary from it, but we'd come together on weekends and evenings and come up with ideas to create things similar to how you're doing the podcast. And it was fun and expressive because our day jobs or in university, there's a little level of frustration when you work with clients because you can't execute things the way you want. And with Yin and Yang, there's freedom and flexibility doing what we want to shoot, what are the narratives that we want to get out there, and also enjoying the perks of flying around the world with brands and press days and all of this other kind of jazz. And that led me to get headhunted for an agency called IUHQ. And I went for an interview before I finished uni, got the job as a social media exec working on ASOS and some Diageo brands. And it was funny because I got it before I finished uni. So it was really hard to motivate myself to finish uni and do my thesis. Did it. I mean, not a single person in the industry has ever asked for my degree, like certificate or grade. Like, it's been pointless in that sense. But I don't regret going to uni because it expanded my network. I met my wife and also allowed me to become more creative, I'd say, being in that environment. And then spent 2 years there and then went to another agency called AKQA. And that was, again, through a Twitter contact that I got connected to, went for a coffee with him. And he was like, look, we just want Nike Sportswear. You should come work here. And I was like, I don't know. And then I remembered like Nike's adverts or something that I was always inspired by watching as a kid. And so when I worked there for a couple of years as a creative, then senior creative, and then some stuff happened and I was trying to figure out my next role. And I was commuting to work and I had this pop-up come up from LinkedIn saying, LinkedIn jobs app is out now. So I downloaded it. And the first job that was there was creative strategist at Instagram. In my head, I was like, there's jobs at Instagram? That are, what, people that work at Instagram? That's how clueless I was about tech industry. So I tweeted, again, another pattern of my life and career is using Twitter. So I tweeted saying, do I know anyone at Facebook or Instagram? And I got connected into someone in San Francisco who was in UX research and someone in London who was a EA. And they both made time for me. She actually called me up the next day and I had three questions. What's the culture like? Am I going to grow? And is there creative freedom? They could answer the first two questions, but their roles weren't as creative. And Tori, the woman in London, she connected me to Alistair, who's a hiring manager. He then calls me, like, we had a Skype call like 2 weeks later. I was hiding in AKQA in a corner whispering during the day. And he saw a bit of himself in me and he referred me in and I had interviews and I got the job. Yeah, that's kind of history.
That's amazing. That is amazing. And it's so nice to have you like be that role model for different cultures to say, look, these are the opportunities that are available to us. And what makes it even more amazing is that we are the era that grew with the internet. You know, we are evolving with the internet and we're adapting with it and making our lives more tech focused, really. I feel like the more internet is evolving, the more we're having to adapt to it. And having creative careers as an opportunity now and as an option for people who are more creative, it's so nice to have people like you really like representing us, both of you, especially Katin, what you're doing behind the scenes for charities. It's amazing work. Like, people don't realize that modern slavery is still around. Like, it's, you know, it is crazy and it bewilders me sometimes at how Gen Z don't actually know a lot about what's going on. It's very either it's on Instagram and it's real or it's not. And that's kind of what we want to open everyone's eyes to. And Niran, obviously, your book is a huge, huge achievement. So what I wanted to ask you is, if you could say in your own few words about your book and what inspired you specifically to focus on helping people build their brands, because I know that you are a huge advocate for helping the community of all communities and making that as transparent as possible and, you know, using your platform to help them grow the way that you've grown. So yeah, in your own few words, what would you say is your inspiration?
Inspiration for the book was actually Mercury reached out to me in January and said, Lamara, the commissioning editor, was like, would you write a book? And she was like, I'm envisioning a book about brands and what you've done for your career. There was nowhere in my life's vision or goal was there become an author and write a book. I'm not a writer. I mean, I did write blog posts daily when I ran the website, but writing, I wouldn't say is my strong point. So I found out, I was thrown off. But at the same time, what Mercury stands for is underrepresented writers from underrepresented communities. And for me, that was why I wanted to do it. It was a way of paying it forward. It wasn't about getting a book out with Mercury or like a popularity contest for me. It was actually sharing some of the knowledge that me and Damola have learned from, I mean, between us, probably about 10 to 15 years in advertising. And so taking some of that knowledge and sharing with people who aren't in the industry, but also inspiring people who want to get into the industry. Yeah, that's essentially it.
Because it really touched us. I know when we last spoke, one thing that you said is you can't become what you can't see. And that has actually really, really resonated with myself. And I've actually said it to quite a few people now, is you actually can't become what you can't see. And when you see someone doing so well and you see your name, an Indian name on a book cover, and you're like, wow, our people are really doing it. Like, we're really opening it up for everyone in our position that didn't know what opportunities were available to them and how to focus their culture and creativity into something positive. What does empowerment mean to you guys? And how do you empower yourself, both of you? Me personally, I like to take a few minutes out of the day just to sit and reflect, or I'd scream at my husband, which is often my therapy. I tell you, it is the best therapy tin. Like, it's just, he knows I've got such a hot head, as so I'm like, and then I'm like, oh, I feel better now. And he's like, really? Yeah. You've just bitten my head off.
I feel empowered, I guess, when I empower others. So yeah, the work that I do, just kind of giving people that in society who are kind of the most vulnerable some sort of voice. Even if it's just my friends, checking in on my friends, especially over lockdown, it's so important, guys, checking on your friends. But also, just kind of over the last year or so, I kind of tried to, yeah, do a lot more reflecting, kind of check in with myself as well. Spend some time kind of meditating or praying or a bit of reading. Not much of a reader. Might read your book at some point. Hey,
thank you.
Thanks. But yeah, just making sure that I carve out that time, because I think as a mum as well, you need to that time of recharge, and there's that guilt that kind of comes alongside it. Like, the mum guilt is real, but yeah, you can't pour out unless you're feeling yourself as well. So it's important to kind of, even if it's just 5 minutes of just me time, and just kind of like, okay, where am I at today? How am I feeling? You know, how do I want the rest of the day to go? Just making sure that all is well, kind of as can be. And then yeah, empowering Naraya and seeing her kind of little growing and just discovering new things. And when she does something, her latest thing is saying, I did it, and we're like, yes, you've did it. So it's just kind of encouraging her here and there, even if it's just like the most basic thing. It's like, oh my gosh, you've just, I don't know, fed yourself a spoonful without making a mess. And it's like, we were all there at once, but
yeah,
it's such an achievement. You've got to celebrate the little achievements. So yeah, that's what I would say is empowerment.
Yeah, no, I think I can relate to Tin on that. On, I get energy from helping others, especially at this stage of my life and career where I've had a lot more experience in things and I can pass on knowledge, especially helping the younger generation. That's when you can't become what you can't see. And I've shared this last week, but I did a talk a few years ago at this conference called Making London. And I usually share my career path and the story of how I got here from the failing and dropping out of uni and then exploring creativity. And this young brown guy comes up to me afterwards and then he's like, I'm from Kerala too. And you're the first person that he dropped out of uni from doing a business degree to chase after doing a career in creative. And he's like, I've been to talks for the last whole month and you are the first person that looks like me. And seeing that, it actually got me choked up, like, because I've done loads of talks, but it's actually rare to come across young brown folk. And hearing that comment was reaffirmed to me that I need to keep doing this and sharing my story and helping break glass ceilings, or in the US they call it glass cliffs. And I'm excited. Like, I think the next like 15 to 20 years here will be, there'll be so many new stories emerging and narratives and people breaking glass ceilings. And what I do to empower myself, I guess self-care in that sense would be, she would say, you spend like 5 hours in the gym. I mentor for my me time is gym time is my me time. It's how I reset. It's like being at home all day with a kid. It can be testing, and I think just for even with the first few months of parenthood, I will still run outside for an hour a day to do a quick workout. It's just getting me in the zone. And if I don't train for a couple of days, she'll tell you I get really annoyed and cranky and hangry, even.
Very snappy.
Yeah. Snappy.
And this is it.
But, yeah.
Mental health is so important, Naran. Like, it's so, I'm so glad you actually said that, and that you take the time out to make sure that you're rejuvenated and you're recharged and you're ready to take on sort of and help your family, really. Because without being recharged and without giving yourself that time, it's pretty much impossible, like you said, Tin, to pour from an empty glass. And being married, what do you guys do to empower each other? Because there's obviously, you know, there's days one person needs a little bit more energy than the other, and it'd be nice just to sort of share that wisdom, really, for other married couples as well, as to how you push each other and grow and have had such a beautiful relationship for so long, how do you guys empower each other?
For example, me to go for an hour in the gym is Tin taking care of Narai on her own, and that's her taking a sacrifice to allow me the freedom to do what I want to do. And I guess, for example, even the book was written in March, and we were stuck at home with no like grandparent support or nursery, so I had to take time out of my weekends to like go lock myself in a room and write, and that was a major sacrifice from Tin and her own well-being to take care of Narai the whole time. So that's what she does. We've been pretty good on dating, like, yeah, still making time for dates, even like from a very like as soon as even when Narai happened, like, we would still make sure that we could have date nights where we can, using tapping into grandparent help. We still go out and do things together. Like, one of our favorite things, like she said, she loves food. We always go out and eat.
Yeah.
So that, yeah.
But then it's also kind of picking up, especially since becoming parents, just when you can kind of hear, like, if I hear Nirman's voice kind of raising, I'm just like, okay, now it's my turn to step in. And then, like, you're tag teaming essentially. But it's also just learning to, like, laugh together and just have fun and crack jokes. Like, we still kind of cuss each other here and there. He cusses me all the time.
All the time.
He's so shady. But then, like,
you have to do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, that's just how it's always been anyway. Like, we're good friends. We kind of share everything. And, yeah, we just kind of check in on each other as well. Just, like, you know, he always kind of senses something's off, he asks me. And he always offers me food.
I'm kind of annoying when I sense like, what's wrong? What's wrong? Is there something wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong?
I'm like, there's nothing wrong, but you're making something wrong. But, yeah, no, we just, like, I don't know.
It's also figuring out what is self-care for each person. Like, for example, her, Moten, I would say, was actually her me time. Yeah, baking is her me time. And my me time is gym, which is two counterproductive things.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely it. Whilst your me times are completely different, those are your forms of empowerment. And allowing each other to do that allows you to empower each other and move forward effectively and have that communication. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on our podcast, guys. It's been a bunch of laughs. I've honestly, I probably lost about 100 calories just sitting here laughing. No need to go to the gym. I'm not like you, and I absolutely hate the gym. I cannot stand.
I'm the same.
Yeah, I've been telling my husband I have to go for a run at 6 a.m. for the last, since March basically. Have I gone for a run? No, and it's cold and it's raining, so it's definitely not happening yet. No gym. It's the traveling from my home to the gym. It's like I could be doing something else in that time.
It's too much effort, Kate. It's like why would we go to the gym when I can cook food? Like, I can just eat food. Yeah. I don't go to the gym.
And then you wash your hair, and I have to think about my hair wash day. So it's, do I want to get my. And that's a real issue. Like, nobody wants to wash and blow their hair. It was really, really lovely having you guys on the show. You guys have been such a laugh, such positive, contagious energy you guys have. Yeah. It's unbelievable. Yeah. If anybody is listening to this podcast, I hope that it really translates how, you know, beautiful you guys are together. And what you're doing is so inspiring. I've taken away a few lessons myself.
That's it for today, guys. Thanks for listening. We will be welcoming more great guests over the next few months, so stay tuned in. Follow us on Spotify and leave a rating and comment on iTunes. In the meantime, follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter to keep up with all things LBW. And don't forget to like, follow, and leave a comment on our posts. We love hearing from you, and we are very, very grateful for your support. Remember to also sign up to our mailing list to receive our monthly newsletter via our Instagram page. This month's newsletter is coming out on the 31st, and it will be a special edition based on Black history, culture, and excellence. So make sure you don't miss out. Until next time, take care, live big, and be kind to yourself.